We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Jack Brown, a London Partnerships Director and lecturer in London Studies at King's College London. The first ever researcher in residence for Number 10 Downing Street from 2016 to 2017, an author of a couple of books, Number 10, The Geography of Power at Downing Street, London's Mayor at 20, Governing a Global City in the 21st Century, and the book we're going to be discussing today, The London Problem. Welcome to the podcast, Jack.
Thank you so much for having me and for that wonderful kind of CV style introduction. Brilliant. I feel really good about myself now. I'm ready.
Fantastic. That's what we aim to do. So the first question that I'd like to ask is, what prompted you to write this particular book?
Sure. So one of the titles, the many titles that you read out there, lecturer in London Studies is my current job at King's College London. Recently became full-time at King's, but before that I was working half-time at King's and half-time at a think tank called Centre for London. Like to get the word London in as much as possible. really good way of batting back accusations of London centrism. But Centre for London, when I went there, it was to produce a report on London's relationship with the rest of the country. This was a couple of years ago now, and it was felt that relations had soured somewhat. There was quite a lot of resentment, particularly at that point, I guess, around the idea of transport infrastructure spending being kind of skewed towards London. But also, post-Brexit, some of these kind of, you know, anti-London sentiment for other reasons, perhaps cultural reasons as well as economic. And so I was kind of brought in to run that project. It wasn't my idea, but I thought it was a very good project. And things have really moved on since then, obviously with the levelling up agenda in particular, that general election 2019 kind of restating the electoral map of the EU referendum. It's kind of taken on new angles. And so I thought, actually, it's time to revisit this and perhaps expand on some of the cultural stuff. I think the original report for Centre for London was quite, you know, London needs to be a little bit more humble. You know, London's coming across as quite arrogant. And I think actually things have changed now. And I've hardened a little bit. I think London's actually getting a bit of an unfair rap now. And so it was kind of updating that and putting that out there. It's a very long-winded way of saying I was updating a report I did in 2019.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned there, and one of the things that you touch upon in the book, is the perception of a cultural difference between London and the rest of the UK, that London is somehow more liberal, perhaps more aligned with the European Union than perhaps the rest of the UK. Why do you think that this perception has been put on London? Do you think that it's purely a result of the 2016 referendum, or do you think that it's something that is much longer and is much of a more of a hardened image for London?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and I think that the 2016 referendum was, to some extent, you know, it's amazing to hear how many people will tell you what it meant, what it all meant. It's obviously a very complex and convoluted thing, you know, with ultimately a binary question and a million different reasons to vote either way. But it didn't create all of our divisions. It didn't create anti-Londonism. It demonstrated it to some extent. But it also, you know, because the rise of UKIP and things like that in 2014, they're beforehand. So to some extent, I think this particular current version of London as a place apart kind of comes maybe after the crash. I think, you know, when London really recovers quite well, the rest of the country doesn't necessarily. Austerity becomes a thing. But then even before that, we've kind of got London's easier transition into a service economy and decline of manufacturing elsewhere. There's kind of all these different patterns coming together. I do think that the referendum leads to a different language, right? So it reflects some difference between London and its economy and reality of life in London for a lot of Londoners, not all. There are many who experience London in a very different way. But it did, you know, show that London was this little yellow island, yellow for Remain, in a kind of blue sea in England, although other cities were, of course, as well. But it did kind of reflect that. But afterwards, the amount that politicians and commentators use phrases like metropolitan elite, liberal metropolitan elite, that's a more willful and deliberate thing that I think really did get accelerated by that 2016 referendum. It's shown to be a winning formula. So, you know, there's these much deeper rooted things going on, structural things. But in terms of how we talk about it and how politicians and leaders talk about it really comes from 2016, I think.
Yeah, and there's that great comparison in the preference when you give a quote from Samuel Johnson that a man who is tired of London, he's tired of life, and then you compare that with a quote from Dominic Cummings saying that journalists should perhaps get out of London and see the more of the country. Do you think in terms of using it as a political sticker, a political... opportunity in terms of making that distinction between London and the rest of the UK, that it was key to the 2019 success of the Conservatives, making that distinction between perhaps London, because of course people have seen all of the what was happening in Parliament at the time over the Brexit vote and perhaps associated that with the rest of London, and that the reason the Conservatives were successful at that election was making that distinction between London and the quote unquote metropolitan elite and the rest of the country.
Yeah, look, I think it's a kind of code word. London is kind of code word for a million different things. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, Parliament and things that were going on in Westminster rather than in London, and in fact not in all of Westminster, because lots of Westminster is very poor. As you know, Westminster as a borough is a really quite a diverse place. But you know, these are all kind of shorthand things, right? So if you're pissed off with the government, if you really don't like what the government is doing, that government is based in Westminster, and sometimes, you know, we did polling at Centre for London. What's the first thing that people think of? Many, many different roles for London in our national life. You know, what's the first thing that you think of those many different roles? Is it a place for tourists? Is it a place where just people live? Is it a financial centre? The number one thing that came up was it's the home of central government. So quite often when people hear London, this is people outside of the capital, first thing that comes to mind is Westminster. So it's a code word for that, as well as many other things that you don't like. This liberal, metropolitan, woke is the more contemporary word that's been, you know, associated to. It's all based on stereotypes. There's one thing I would go back to saying, because I only realised this the other day. 40% of Londoners voted to leave, actually, in that referendum, but London did overall vote to remain. But there's more leave voters in London than there are or there were in 2016, rather, in the northeast, for example, just because there's more people in London. And the same is true of the East Midlands. You know, there are a huge number of Leave voters in London, a huge number of poor people. Poverty rates are actually higher in London than the rest of the country, particularly after housing costs. So it's based on stereotypes. It's all based on associations and stereotypes. And sometimes this is weaponized by people who want to create an enemy and say, you know, particularly by elites. The thing that's quite remarkable, I think, in recent times is the amount of elites who are criticizing other elites of being elites, which is, you know, it makes me laugh, to be honest. It's quite transparent. That's not to say there aren't legitimate regional inequalities, but there is this other aspect, right?
One of the things that you mentioned there and you talk about as well in the book is the disparity between different parts of London. You mentioned there that there are higher rates of inequality and poverty in London than the rest of the UK. Do you think that for people to fully recognise the diversity of London and that there are these great disparities, that more has to be said about some of the inequalities in London than perhaps is at the moment, because like you say, people just think of it as, oh, well, this is where the government is based, therefore it's, you know, a place for perhaps more privileged people than it is for people across the economic spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to have two conversations simultaneously, because two things are true, which is, you know, a horrible phrase, because it always means that you sound kind of like you're sitting on the fence, and it's complicated to communicate. But yes, London is home to political power, but also financial power. A lot of billionaires, majority of the country's billionaires. There is great wealth in London. It does, the wealthy part of London subsidises spending in the rest of the country. It generates so much in tax. And so London is vital for the national economy. That's one thing. And then the other truth is that poverty rates are also in parts of the city, which is a big, complicated place with 9 million people. Poverty rates are higher than the rest of the country. And it's very difficult. Say you are the mayor of London, let's make you mayor of London. About time, Will, I bet. Not you necessarily want to be mayor of London, but, you know, a job of that stature. Yeah. In this case, it's mayor of London. How are you going to communicate simultaneously to the country and to the world that this is the goose that lays the golden egg for the rest of the country in terms of its economy, that it's vital, it's so vibrant and powerful and wonderful. And also it's a place of incredible poverty and it really needs more assistance, you know, because those two things don't sit easily, but those two things are true, because London's just so big. It's so much bigger than the next biggest city. Just through accidents of history, just through the fact that over time, that's the way it's evolved. Governments have been trying to address this for decades and decades and decades, and it's never quite managed. But yes, we need to talk about poverty in London, because it is serious, it is in some cases endemic. And those people, you know, poorer Londoners are also real people. You know, they are left behind, if you're going to use that phrase, which isn't a great phrase. But, you know, if anybody is in this country, if anybody needs levelling up, there's plenty of people in London and communities in London that need that. Two, not more or less than other parts of the country, but just as much, because we are the same, ultimately.
I think one of the things that you touch upon this as well a bit in the book, in terms of the disparity, one of the things that I think really brought it home to people was the Grenfell Tower fire, which of course happened in Kensington, you know, which is a generally considered a fairly wealthy part of London, but also has, you know, and had at the time of Grenfell, a great deal of social housing and inequality. Do you think then that in terms of social housing and looking after people in London as well as in the west of the UK, that more has to be done to focus on the fact that there is, you know, a housing crisis, that if things don't get done in terms of building houses, you know, this is only a situation that's going to get worse and worse. The housing crisis is talked about a lot, but often we don't have perhaps as stark examples as in the case of Grenfell.
Yeah, I mean... So Kensington and Chelsea is, a particularly affluent borough overall, but with extreme poverty. As you mentioned, it's kind of London in microcosm to some extent there, right? Same sort of pattern, serious wealth and serious poverty. And whilst I'm not a proponent or enthusiast for inequality, the alternative is worse, right? I don't know if it's really true, but the stereotype of Paris is a very affluent centre and very poor suburbs, you know, quite segregated in that respect. Might be being totally unfair on Paris, but let's just say that that's the case. Yeah. Better not to replicate that model, whether it exists in Paris or not, because, you know, whilst inequality can be grating, actually mixed communities are better than segregated communities. But more does need to be done to help, you know, reduce that gap and particularly to provide a better safety net. The housing cost crisis, which is probably separate to what happened at Grenfell, which is a real horrific tragedy around the cladding specifically and fire safety. But the kind of general not producing enough housing, demand being so high, costs going right up, and that driving poverty is a real kind of London-wide thing. And it goes out into the southeast, and up, there are plenty of other parts of the country where this is the case, but it's mainly a kind of a southeastern crisis, really. And that does fuel, successive mayors of London, different leaders of London boroughs, different governments have all struggled to address this because it's just very hard to deliver enough housing to meet need. One really good way of addressing this would be levelling up successfully, would be, you know, having a series of cities across the country that people really, really, that have similar draw to London. That would take some of the pressure off of London, and that would hopefully, therefore, you know, as demand goes down, the prices come down. That could solve it. My fear with levelling up is that, you know, it's easier to level London down, right? To take money away from the capital and just put it elsewhere. But if you could genuinely achieve that, which, like I say, successive governments have been trying to do, it's very difficult. That's not to say it's impossible. That would be really good for poor people in London as well. I totally agree that housing is a really difficult but really important area to address.
We're going to take a short break from my conversation with Jack to hear a trailer for the Politics of Sound podcast episode with Marc Francois, which you can listen to wherever you listen to your podcasts. When we come back, we'll be discussing further the ways that London is perceived, regional devolution, whether that would engage people more with local politics and get them more invested in politics, and much, much more. We'll be back in a moment.
Do you want to see your politicians from a different angle? It's time for the Politics of Sound podcast. I believe that people's record collections can reveal a lot about them, and so every month I invite politicians and political figures to reveal their three all-time favourite albums, and in exchange, I want to know all about them and their lives, what they think, and why they think it. My guest this month is the controversial politician and chairman of the ERG group, Marc Francois. So why not join me, Ian Carnegie, my guests, and the house band on the Politics of Sound podcast, out now on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you mentioned they're moving parts of trying to level up, potentially stimulating other parts of the country. Now, one of the proposed ways of doing that is the government have suggested moving parts of the Treasury to the north and other parts of the government, other government departments to different parts of the UK. Do you think that that would necessarily help, you know, areas of the UK in the north or the east or wherever? Or do you think that it would be more a case, as you said, they're potentially hindering London by taking people who would be otherwise contributing to the economy of London and taking them out of the system and shoving them somewhere else?
I guess I should clarify there, because personally I'm quite kind of agnostic on the idea of moving civil servants or government departments or even parliament, you know, it is falling apart, moving it to another part of the country. I don't think it can do it. It's going to do massive harm. There are more civil servants outside of London than there are in London now, but most of the senior civil servants are still in London. But that's because there is a sort of agglomeration benefit of having your main civil servants around your main politicians, around lots of the supporting, you know, industries. If you move the whole caboodle to another city, you'd just create a similar problem there, which is, for me, too much centralised power, not enough devolved power for different regions to initiate policies, to spend money and raise taxes in a way that suits them, to build local growth. For me, I think devolution, rather than putting a part of the very centralised civil service somewhere, I think it'd be much better to give them a much stronger local mayor. I'm kind of with Michael Heseltine on this, where he says, you know, show me a problem, show me who's in charge. You know, if you put someone in charge who's close to the ground, you can really sort of advocate for and respond to local issues. I think that's the best way of levelling up personally. When I talk about risk of levelling London down, I'm not really talking about moving, you know, oh, London needs to keep all of its civil servants or more of the BBC or whatever. What I'm talking about is government deciding, let's not invest in Crossrail 2, let's instead put that money elsewhere. Let's not, this was talked about in universities, let's potentially take away the London waiting from London universities and just give it to other parts of the country. So it's just taking resources is more what I'm talking about rather than people. And I think you need to not treat it in a kind of zero-sum way. Like, we need a really thriving world city in London, and we need to invest elsewhere as well. I mean, that sounds a bit like, you know, magic money tree, but I do think this is investment. It's not just throwing money away. And that's more what I'm talking about. But my concern is more about kind of resources than people. I think there's a perfectly legitimate argument for putting Parliament somewhere else. I just don't think it's going to transform. I don't think if the Treasury turns up in your town, your town is suddenly going to become a really exciting, enterprising place to be. Just really quickly, I did my PhD on Canary Wharf and Docklands in London's East End, which was a really rundown place before they built Canary Wharf. And Canary Wharf, the development as we know it today, was really struggling in the early 90s. It went bankrupt, actually, and they considered moving the Department of the Environment down there. And the guy who was in charge of running Canary Wharf at the time, while it was in administration, said, nah, we don't want those sort of people here. Like, you know, it would be really good because we've got all these empty buildings. We're really struggling. But if we fill them with civil servants, we're not going to fill them with enterprising startups, you know, and exciting. And the whole atmosphere is not going to be built. And so it's a kind of a short-term fix where actually we want to build somewhere that young people want to be. We want to build something. I'm not having to go at civil servants here. But you know, it's a slightly different thing that I think leads to a more equal country. I think it's working out how to get that private sector, 80% or so of jobs are in the private sector. How do you get that going in a locality? And that's not necessarily by moving a part of public administration there, in my view. What do you think, Will? Or do you not share your views on these things?
Well, I mean, I think it could, like you said, I think it could help, but equally it might not actually help in terms of investment. Like you say, I think it would be better if you're encouraging people who are actually creating businesses and creating jobs to, you know, give them support in those areas, rather than just saying, well, we're just going to take a certain element of the government and shove it there. You know,
the word shove is quite a loaded word, isn't it? But it does. Yes, no, exactly. No, I personally would agree, but I can't say I've got all the answers here. This is, unfortunately, the book is a little bit more about the problem than
the solutions.
The solution. I do believe that, you know, if anything is the solution, it's more devolution, investment in infrastructure, investment in skills.
Yeah,
these sort of things.
In terms of devolution, you mentioned it a little bit before. Do you think that, for example, the London Assembly, which of course, you know, has a certain amount of influence on the capital, do you think that perhaps there should be more focus on what happens in the Assembly? Because perhaps people, whether they be in London or outside London, perhaps don't follow the inner workings of the London Assembly perhaps as closely as they should do.
Are you talking about the Greater London Authority, mayor and the Assembly? So there's the mayor and the mayor's office, and then the London Assembly is the body that kind of scrutinises the mayor's office, which doesn't have a huge amount of power, actually, but the mayoralty does have quite a lot of power, mainly in kind of convening, in saying, I am the mayor and millions of people voted for me. It's one of the biggest personal direct mandates in Western Europe. More than the Prime Minister. More people vote directly for the mayor than the Prime Minister. So yes, I would agree that what they get up to probably does need a little bit more attention. I think that the recent elections showed the power of mayors potentially. Mm-hmm. You know, Andy Burnham has really, you know, come into his own in advocating for actually the North, not just Greater Manchester, over the local lockdowns and throughout the pandemic. But Ben Houchen up in the Northeast as well, Andy Street, not just Labour mayors, but a series of Metro mayors have kind of quite identifiable achievements that they can point to. Up in the Northeast, they've sort of basically nationalised an airport. You know, it's quite a big thing, yeah. And it seems to be working. And so I think these mayors are relatively underpowered. Mm-hmm. I think that you could devolve a little bit more responsibility, a little bit more tax-raising powers, not just because I want them to have, you know, increased taxes or have more money, but because that's just the reality of how you get things done. You need a bit more power, a bit more money. And then I think the public understanding of what they get up to would probably follow, because actually your list, if you're the current mayor of London, your list of direct powers, you've got quite a lot of power over transport, although at the moment that's all been taken away because transport is bankrupt because of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. You have some influence over the Met Police, but they're also accountable to the Home Office. Mm-hmm. You kind of share that, and you have other powers that deliver a bit of housing, but most housing isn't delivered by you. You have quite a limited set of powers. And so I think to some extent, the amount of coverage and understanding that the public has of this role is linked to how much power they actually have to do stuff. So more power, more scrutiny, good.
Do you think then that if mayors in different parts of the country had more power, that this would perhaps make it easier for people to get engaged more in local and regional politics? If they felt that mayors had more power, they might think, oh, well, I'm going to be more likely to follow what they're doing and therefore contribute more to the political debate in my local area.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think so. I like the idea that that more substantial figures, you know, we haven't got a history like France does of, you know, of politicians being a mayor of a major city, then going on to lead the country. Mm. We do now. We have a precedent. But, you know, not a president, but a precedent. In Boris Johnson, a former mayor. And that gives more prominence to the role, to the mayoralty. And over time, you attract more kind of substantial figures, people who have big political talent or political ambition, and that means more people will pay attention to it, because it's you know, actually people know who Andy Burnham is now. They know that there is a mayor there advocating for them, and that can only be good for local politics. I mean, I would say that there's a whole layer beneath these mayors, you know, beneath Burnham, beneath Sadiq Khan, of boroughs, and you know, perhaps there isn't always that kind of trickle down that people go, okay, well, I'm going to go get involved with my local council. Stronger local leadership, I do think, would lead to more engagement. I think people trust. I think if you look at sort of the Ipsos veracity indexes that they produce, they see who's the most and least trusted professions in the country each year. And it's always, you know, government, central government is always right down the bottom, but local councillors tend to be quite a lot higher up. You know, people do kind of trust, because it's a more human level, right? You know, the closer it is to you, the more relatable it is, the more likely you are going to see them, you're going to get some interaction from them, you're going to see the change that they implement. And so, I'm a big believer in the principle that sort of local is broadly better.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great speaking to you, Jack, and I have one final question. We've not really touched upon it much, but of course coronavirus has limited the amount of things that we'll be able to do, though hopefully things are getting better in terms of the rollout of the vaccination, etc. When things return to normal, what one thing that you haven't been able to do are you most looking forward to being able to do?
Me personally?
Yeah.
See, if you'd have asked me A little while, only a few weeks ago, I wanted to see my family so badly. My mum and dad, they live in different places. They both moved out of London in recent years, so I haven't really seen them. My dad's particularly vulnerable, so that was a huge thing to go and see them, even outdoors. I would have said going to football because I am a season ticket holder at the Emirates Stadium, follow Arsenal, and was missing that hugely. But I went to the last game of the season, very socially distanced, and it was weird. And you know, you could hear the air conditioning above you. I think going back to see some live music, I think is the thing that I'm still missing. I'm quite happy at the moment with this. It's awful for businesses, but this stage of lockdown, I don't know about you, but like I can see the people that I need to see. I feel that human connection's back. But live music, oh my God, like missed that dearly. I wasn't even going to that many gigs before. kind of getting really lazy and complacent, but I realise how much I miss that now. What's your number one, or have you done this already?
I think, like you say, just being able to get out, get to see some live events. There were quite a few that I was meant to be going to in the start of 2020 that just went, and probably might not happen again. Hopefully they do. Just being able to get out and to see people like I used to be able to.
Yes, without booking. Oh my God, without planning like 3 weeks in advance. That would be incredible. Should we go for a pint? Oh, it's possible. Wow, you can just do that. You know, that would be a dream world. But at the moment, to be honest, just some good news on the virus, because at the moment it does seem to be, you know, it's very up and down. Mm. And any sort of progress, I think I'd be very happy about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Jack. If people want to get The London Problem, where should they go to get it?
They can go to a bookshop now, I guess, can't they? You know, they physically be allowed in. I don't know if they'd have it. it depends on the bookshop. But I would ask you to go to Haust, the publisher's website, Haus Publishing, and buy it directly from them rather than from one of the massive online retailers. Although, you know, if you're going to buy it, then I appreciate that regardless.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.